Bem-vindos to one more episode of the Type Theory for Our Podcast. As always, this is your host, Pedro Abreu, talking to you directly from Brasilia, Brazil. In this episode, I talked with a great friend of mine, Raghav Malik, who has just defended his PhD at Purdue on the topic of compilers for privacy-preserving computation. During this episode, we have some conversation about his PhD thesis, awesome compiler work. One thing very particular about Raghav is that he actually spent some years in grad school going all the way down into rabbit hole to learn category theory from a mathematical perspective from first principles. So he took a bunch of classes, and in this conversation, he tells us about this journey. And of course, I was dying to ask him if category theory is really all that to learn the foundations of programming languages. Or, you know, does learning category theory really make you a better PL researcher? Well, let's find out. And of course, I wouldn't finish the episode without asking him how he coped with mental health during his PhD journey. So I hope you guys enjoy this conversation, because it was very special for me having this conversation in person. This conversation was held right after the last episode with Francil. So keep that in mind. It was just doing one thing after the other. And at some point, you're also going to hear Francil in the back asking some questions. So that was really fun. Now, before we start the actual episode, I'll be entirely honest with you guys. I'm here requesting your help. Currently, the operational costs of this podcast is nearly around $300 a month, because we need to pay servers, accounting, editing, all of that. I've tried for the whole year to reach out to many different companies for sponsorship, but it's become clear to me that this project is so super niche that not even companies are interested in supporting us. So I basically will have to rely on you guys, patrons, to try to cover that cost. Currently, our beloved patrons, which I leave their names somewhere here, I think here, as a big thank you. Currently, revenue that we make with their assistance covers around a third of that value. And quite frankly, I don't know how much longer I'll be able to cover the rest of it out of my pocket. So I'm here to request your help. If you're able to spare $5 or $10 a month to our cause, it would mean the world to me. Patrons get exclusive access to Discord channels, gets to send questions for upcoming guests, and even one-on-one time directly with me. And of course, you can get your name showcased in the episode, just like this just showed up. Another super exciting news is that now we've also been releasing a new super exclusive podcast only for patrons. And of course, I had to name it Type Theory Exists. Type Theory Exists is a short format of podcast where I release behind the scenes of the episodes, I share my experiences at the conferences that I attend, my traveling, and I get a lot more personal and frank with you guys. So anyways, if you would like to support the show to keep us alive, please consider becoming a patron. Simply go to our website, typetheoryforall.com/patreon, or go to the website and follow the prompts. Of course, we also have the merch store, which has helped a little bit to get some revenue. But to be entirely honest, some of the months I can't even cover the operational cost of the shop itself, because there is a cost for Printify, for Shopify, and if I don't sell a particular amount, you don't even cover that. There's that, but this month at least things are going really well, because we have a Black Friday. In this Black Friday, you get 15% off right on checkout. So go to the website and check out the awesome Type Theory products that we've got over there. But you know, if you're not able to support monthly, or you're not interested in buying some very, very nice cool merch, really also appreciate one-off supports through our Ko-Fi platform, ko-fi.com/typetheoryforall. And we are currently actually fundraising to buy a proper camera set so that I don't need to record these episodes on my iPhone, because yes, I am literally looking at my iPhone 13 right now. And I think it's time for us to get better, especially now that we're starting to get some in-personal interviews. So it's time. We've also been doing some Twitch recordings, and a camera will be really, really nice to keep those going. Anyways, that's what I had to share with you guys. Now, without further ado, let's get into this episode. Welcome to one more episode of the Type Theory for All podcast. It's been such a long time since the recording of the last episode. No, I'm kidding. It was literally 5 minutes ago when I finished talking with Francil, and now we're gonna do a back-to-back conversation with Raghav. It's probably gonna be released a little bit further from one another. Hey Raghav, I forgot to ask. We've been together this many years. How do I say your surname?
Malik.
Raghav Malik. So today I'm here with the incredible one and only Raghav Malik. Thanks for coming here, brother.
Be here.
Okay, so just to give some background, which year did you join? Was it
2019.
I was here in 2018, so we go way back, huh? I remember. I think you saw me in one of the first houses I got here.
Yeah,
I think we were hanging out there like when I was just moving in. Angelo
yep.
was here, right?
Yep.
Oh, good times, brother. Good times. We've been through a lot. Okay, so we're here now because here's what we had in mind. We're talking with Francil that is just, you know, finishing her undergrad and wanting to go into a PhD. And Raghav here just finished his PhD.
That's right.
And let's talk about it, man. So let's start with your trajectory. First of all, you're actually from Purdue. You did your undergrad at Purdue. What is your trajectory going into, you know, like this PL kind of research?
So I ended up in PL largely through a series of accidents. My first year at Purdue, I took a class, like an advanced C programming or whatever. Millen, who is now my advisor, was the professor for that class. And so because I was a sort of precocious, annoying little freshman, I would like raise my hand, like, you know, 200 person lecture, I would like raise my hand and like interrupt and ask him questions all the time. I would like stay after class and like just like pester him with questions that I had about the lecture, about other things. I found out by like stalking his website that he does like compilers research, and this was like something that I thought was really cool because I was like, well, I know how to like write programs, how do I write programs that read other programs, whatever, right? And so I talked to him a lot like my freshman year, and then when I was applying to grad schools, Purdue was of course, you know, one of the places that I applied to, and I thought that I was going to do more like cryptography or like security, like cybersecurity, that kind of thing. But he saw my application and he recognized my name and he sent me an email and he was like, hey, I remember you from my 264 class, from C. And I have this project that is like kind of cryptography, kind of some other stuff. Do you want to get coffee and we can like talk about it? And I was like, this is amazing. He was like my favorite professor. I like didn't realize that he remembered me. And so I like met with him and he like explained the project to me and I was like, this sounds really cool. This sounds like, you know, something that I'd be really interested in working on. And so I took the offer and I joined his group and, here we are.
Damn, that's kind of the dream, having the professor to reach out to you, right?
Honestly, yeah. Yeah. I did not realize that this wasn't normal until after I started.
Congratulations. But, yeah. That's incredible. But it also tells about your passion and your interest in a class because, I mean, I remember I had a friend this one time that we met in high school and then we went to college more or less together. So like we were hanging out as friends. And one day he looks at me and he's like, Pedro, I got to be honest with you. In high school, I fucking hated you because you would ask so many annoying questions. You would just stop class all the time to ask questions. And now I get like you didn't mean to interrupt or to be mean. You're honestly curious, right? And I appreciate that. And I'm like, oh man, thanks. I guess. So that's kind of it, right? Like I think there's something about it, about this, you know, like research curiosity, you know, like the professors, like the turn on the professors, kind of, you know, like that. Yeah, there's some spark over there, and I'm sure that this is something that I definitely felt with Francil as well. She would come in and would ask these questions, right? And like would get me going and like allow me to present her all the cool things that I've been learning these past years that get me going, you know. So that really, really hits a bell. And probably also tells a little bit about probably weren't a bad student. You're probably a good student, like got good grades with Millen as well, right? Yeah. So otherwise he wouldn't trust enough to make this offer to you. So yeah, that's
That's really cool. So tell us more about this project that he offered.
So this was a huge like grant that they got. And so it was like four professors from the PL or like four PL professors and four crypto professors. And it was the idea was so multi-party computation, right? The goal of multi-party computation is you've got a bunch of parties who don't trust each other, but they want to sort of collaborate to compute some function over their private inputs, right? So the standard, like, the example that maybe spawned this is, like, you know, the millionaire problem. You've got two millionaires who are arguing about who has, like, a greater net worth, but neither of them wants to, like, say their net worth out loud for fear of, like, being the smaller one. And so they want to compute this, like, less than function or greater than function without revealing their private input. And it turns out that, like, the cryptography community has figured out how to do this a couple decades ago, but writing programs that use multi-party computation can be very tedious, but it's also very hard to write these, like, correctly, especially if you don't have a ton of cryptographic expertise, right? And so the project was sort of this, like, big collaboration of, like, can we build a language that has, like, all of the fancy, like, language design and, like, type system and, like, compiler optimization stuff that the PL people know how to do, while also baking in all of the sort of cryptographic expertise that, like, the crypto people know how to do, like, picking the right protocol, doing these, like, protocol specific optimizations and things like that. And so it was this big collab of, like, can we build this language that sort of knows how to do MPC correctly. You know, that really appealed to me because, as I said, like, building a compiler, like, building a programming language or something, like, I knew nothing about PL, right? I knew nothing about, like PL theory or anything like that. But I was like, oh, like, writing a programming language sounds really cool. And also, I'm very interested in, like, the like, security and the, like, cryptography sort of stuff. So this was, like, I don't know, this really, really appealed to me, the project.
That is pretty cool. So how do you do that? How do you do this? Like, what is the idea for doing this kind of computation securely?
So there's a lot of different multi-party protocols. The one that I particularly care about in my research is this thing called fully homomorphic encryption. So it turns out that there are ways to encrypt like integers, like numbers, whatever, such that the ciphertexts, the things that you've actually encrypted, still have a little bit of structure, and you can, like, make use of the structure to, you know, like, add or multiply or, like, do some very, very basic operations over these ciphertexts in a way that, you know, corresponds to something interesting over the things that you encrypted in the first place, over the plain texts. You take whatever complicated thing you want to compute and you break it down into a bunch of these, like, smaller functions, and then you evaluate these one at a time over the ciphertexts. It's a lot of really fancy math that I don't completely understand, but I've tried to. It works. It's really slow, but it works.
And we're not really, really too worried about being slow, are we, in this particular setting?
I am.
You are?
I'm very worried about it being slow.
Okay, so...
Yeah, that's... I mean, my entire thesis is, hey, this is really, really slow. How do we make this faster?
And how do you do it?
You know, that's a good question. You do it by knowing what the underlying cryptography looks like. So this is kind of a thing that I alluded to earlier with this, like, big collaboration. But, you know, especially in the case of, you know, things like homomorphic encryption, the way people tend to treat this problem is we've got a crypto system or we've got an encryption scheme that gives us, you know, a fixed set of functions that we know how to evaluate, right? Maybe you know how to add and multiply, and maybe that's it. And this is complete. This is enough. Whatever program you have, you can express it as, like, a big circuit that uses adds and multiplies. And so then the compilers people say, okay, we know how to take programs and translate them into circuits. We've been doing this for decades. And the crypto people say, we know how to take circuits. We know how to evaluate them gate by gate. And then, okay, you just, like, combine these together and you get something that works, but it's really, really slow because, like, every single gate evaluation is, like, you know, four or five orders of magnitude slower than it should be. But where my work comes in is, like, there's a lot of, like, neither of these communities are really operating at their full capacity, if that makes sense. Like, compilers people know how to do a ton of really, really cool like compiler analyses and optimizations and stuff that just don't make sense when the thing you're looking at is like ciphertexts, right? Like we don't have, if everything's a circuit, for example, you don't have like interesting notions of like, you know, pointer aliasing or like control flow or like stuff like this. And at the same time, like the crypto community knows how to do, you know, some very, very specific operations or optimizations or protocols or whatever that are hard to teach a compiler how to make use of. But like a team of cryptographers can sit down for like several months and like write a paper that says, okay, we figured out how to do this one cool thing. And here's how we use this to accelerate this one specific protocol. And so we can do this like one thing faster. Right. And it's very specialized and it takes a lot of expertise. And so compiler is like, you know, the compiler is not going to target this instruction if it has no idea that it exists or like no idea how it works. So yeah, like these communities are not operating at their full capacities. And so my work tries to kind of bridge that gap a little bit by saying like, well, on the one hand, how do we take some of these more clever, you know, compilation techniques that we know how to do in like, I'll say, a classical space? And how do we sort of port them into something that makes sense over crypto? And on the other hand, how do we take the really clever specific protocols that cryptographers have built and I don't know, maybe rework the abstraction somehow to make them friendly to compilers or to make compilers able to make use of these and things like that?
That's interesting. Wow. I never thought about it, but it does make a lot of sense. I was doing some work too in this more cryptography stuff, and it definitely feels like these are just two communities, because cryptographers are basically math people.
Yeah.
Right. And they're very, very heavy on math, and like they have no idea what kinds of like formal tools we can use to formalize this work or to specify this work. They're so abstractly in math, right? And they do not care about any of this. They just want to make things more and more secure and understand, you know, and especially nowadays in the field of post-quantum cryptography with all this homomorphic elliptic curve stuff, right? It got very, very, very hairy, very quick, and a little scary for us who are on the outside. How was that for you? You know, this is what I want to understand, because I remember when it's been a while we don't talk really, but back then you would always, you know, like you have shown a lot of knowledge in like category theory and programming languages, semantic kind of stuff. Like, first, how did you get into all of this stuff? And second, how did you feel, you know, like learning more about cryptography? Do you consider yourself a cryptography expert these days? Like, what is...
I don't consider myself an expert by a long shot. The category theory and the type theory, like this stuff, was actually kind of unrelated to the cryptography side of things. But this was more a result of me being very stubborn. So I did the standard like person who's new to PL thing of like, you know, everyone talks about Haskell, I should pick up this language. Oh wait, everyone's talking about monads, I wonder what a monad is. Okay, let me like do a little bit of Googling.
Yeah. Huh.
Okay, there's this thing called category theory. I feel like to really understand Haskell, I need to learn category theory, which is not true. But I was like, okay, so I need to learn some category theory. And so my second semester of grad school, I enrolled in a math class. It was a like MA 598, so it was like a topics class, not like, it was like one of those classes where the professor shows up and like talks about their research to like 8 students or whatever for the semester. And the title of the class was Higher Category Theory. Now, to me at the time, who knew like what a functor was and nothing else, higher meant that this was the graduate version of the class. And so I was like, oh, perfect. I'm a grad student. I can take a grad class on category theory. I already know what a functor is, so I'm like ahead of the curve. And I showed up. And so, okay, so higher, the word higher in higher category theory refers to doing category theory in infinite dimensions. So category, like, yeah, like infinity categories, whatever, which I didn't know at the time. But I showed up to the first lecture, and within the first 10 minutes, the professor like starts talking about If you take this like cofibrant replacement of this thing, and you've got this like chain complex and computed cohomology, blah 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 blah. And I'm like over here trying to like scribble down every word he says so I can Google it later. But I'm like, you know what? This is fine. Like first day, he's sort of giving us a preview of what the entire semester is going to look like, and this is going to be a hard class, but like I'll catch up. And then he like does this, and then he goes, "Oh yeah, I'm really sorry, I'm going slow right now, but this is just the first day. I promise we'll pick up the pace." And you know, I'm still looking at my notebook. I'm like, "Huh, that's a funny joke." And I look up, and there's like math grad students all around me, like, "Oh yeah, it's okay. We understand that it's going to be slow." I was like, "And we're dropping this." And I just, it felt so bad to like show up to 10 minutes of a class and like immediately be confronted with like the wealth of knowledge that I do not have. That I was like, I can't stand this. Like that was a terrible day. I felt terrible. And I was like, okay, you know what? This is the start of my revenge arc. So, I found out like an appropriate sequence of math classes to take to sort of like learn all of the prerequisites, to like try to take this class again or like try to learn the stuff for this class again. So it ended up being like, you know, algebraic topology is kind of the main thing that you need to know before going to higher category theory.
You need topology for that, then?
Yeah. So algebraic topology, which means you need algebra and topology. And then once you've got this, you can sort of like start doing more category theory stuff. So I was like, okay, I'm going to start with like a point set topology class. And I'm going to start with an algebra class. And, you know, algebra to me is like, oh yeah, I took algebra 2 in high school, this is fine. And of course that's not what it is at like for math grad students. And so like a very similar thing happened in the first algebra class I enrolled in. It was so stupid. But yeah, I spent the next essentially year and a half just like going through prerequisite after prerequisite. And as a very funny coincidence, the professor who was teaching the higher category theory class was also my point set topology professor, was also my algebraic topology professor. And so I did end up learning category theory from him as part of the like the algtop class. But I found out like about halfway through the class that he was really interested in like formally verifying some of his theorems. And so, you know, he knew me as like the you know, the CS kid who takes all the math classes. And so he was like, "Hey, do you know anything about like formal verification?" And I was like, "Yes, I do. Do you want to talk about it sometime?" And so we started this like reading group the following semester on HOT, like homotopy type theory, because he was like, "I want to learn some homotopy type theory. I can help with the homotopy part, you can help with the type theory part." And I was like, "That sounds great." So I learned HOT just like we went through the HOT book and we went through like for like a semester or whatever and like learned all of this stuff. I did get my revenge because most of the reading sessions were like, you know, I would like prep a chapter and like try to explain it. He would like fill in the gaps or whatever. And so I got to on the very first day where I was explaining like Martin Luft type theory and like inference rules and stuff like that. I got to say the line of like, "Look, I'm sorry this is going really slowly, but I promise this is just the first chapter. We'll pick up the pace." He was so confused. I was like, "Oh, you don't remember from like 2 years ago?"
That is so great, man.
It was a good moment.
But this reading group was only the two of you?
It was the two of us, and then a third person joined about like halfway through. But yeah.
Dude, I had no idea that you were taking all these classes. I might have joined you if I knew.
Yeah, no, it was crazy. Yeah. It was like,
I think I remember that when you invite, like, I think you invited everyone for the HOT class,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I think I remember that. But like, I was like, there is no way I'll be able to follow this shit. Fuck it.
Yep.
So how did it go?
No, it went really well, and I mean, you know, despite my initial rage at this man, like he's really, really nice. You know, he taught me basically all the category theory I know. I took a bunch of classes with him after that just because like he was teaching them and I was like very interested. And yeah, like it went well. I now, you know, I've slowly like crawled my way out of this rabbit hole that I fell in.
Yes.
But it was a really fun time.
So what are your thoughts now that you're on the other side? How does it not even influence, like, how does this knowledge not only influence, but like, what is it, does, is it, you, do you think it's useful in our field? Like, what are your thoughts? Like, what did you gain in, because I mean, as someone who is excited about this stuff, you gain everything, right? You know what is going on now, right? And I envy you, I really do. But objectively, like, how does it influence type theory, right, or programming languages?
When I was on my way down this rabbit hole, this is something that I would keep telling myself and keep telling Millen, who, you know, to his credit, was like supportive, if a little bit confused about all of this like extra nonsense that I was doing.
But that's a lot of work that you're putting extra. Yeah.
Yeah. But I was like, you know, someday all of this stuff that I know about like Hochschild homology is going to come up and I'm going to have a problem and I'm going to recognize it as, you know, as this like, as this thing, and just like be able to like make a perfect connection, and it's going to be great. And that hasn't happened, like not even close. I've tried on multiple occasions. I've tried like sending Millen a wall of text that's basically like, look, I think you can think about this like compiler problem that we have as like a DG algebra over blah 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 blah. And he'll listen along for a while, and he'll ask a few questions, and at the end of it, he'll be like, okay, so what? And I'll be like, yeah, I don't know. But it just, yeah, like it doesn't come up in any like concrete way, I think. I do think like doing all of this, like learning all of this math, has made me better at learning new things, because there was no, you know, I had absolutely no background going into this, right? Like absolutely no like real mathematical background. And I'm taking classes that are designed for math majors who like have had a math undergrad and like have actually done some of this, and so
they're good, man.
They're good.
Fucking good.
Yeah, right. There's a lot of things where like I would be in class and, you know, people around me would be nodding and understanding, and I would be like, oh, I don't know this at all. I have to understand what I can and look this up later. And that was like kind of a new experience for me. And I think it was good. Like I think it like taught me how to learn new things really well. And like that was a skill that I was able to sort of transfer back to trying to learn like PL things. I also think it made me very comfortable with abstractions, because like, right, you know, one of the things about like category theory or like, you know, these like infinity categories or whatever is like it's all abstractions built on top of abstractions built on top of other abstractions. And you could try to like drill all the way down if you wanted, but you would genuinely, I think, go crazy. Like the Eldritch horror would just be like too much. And so you have to get very comfortable with like, okay, I've understood things up to this point. I'm going to stop here. And like, this is now my new level of abstraction. And I'm only going to think about things above this. And that's also another like really useful skill, I think, for dealing with some of the crazier PL stuff. So yeah, I don't know. I think a lot of like soft skills transferred over, even if the like the technical content didn't really in a way that I was hoping it would.
Are you still doing like in your PhD, were you still doing functional programming or more on the compiler's hardware side of things?
I was definitely more on the compiler side.
Yeah.
We had some like, you know, there's some language design things that you have to care about. There's some like, you know, I've had to write down like typing rules and stuff like that. But
what conferences were you aiming for? Because you're neither in cryptography, neither entirely. It was more compilers things, right?
Yeah, yeah. It is definitely more targeted towards the PL community. So like PLDI, for example, Asplos, Upsala. We did try submitting to security conferences a couple of times, but it turns out that when your advisor is a PL person, you become very, very PL brained, and so like the way that I would write my papers would not be good or useful to cryptographers. So yeah, mostly PL.
That is so funny, man. That is so great. Oh yeah, I was asking about the functional programming part, because Philip Water could see the use of monads in functional programming. And it gets me kind of curious, like what are the other beautiful little gems of concepts that we could kind of transport back into programming languages or functional programming, or, you know, beautiful little mathematical abstractions. But
to be honest, I like, this might be a hot take. This might get me canceled for saying this on the Type Theory for All podcast, but I don't think category theory is useful for understanding monads and Haskell. I think monads and Haskell are a software engineering pattern that happens to have the same name as a category theoretic concept. Like, I know that this is why I started looking into category theory in the first place, because I you know, drank the Kool-Aid or whatever. But I don't know, like, knowing all of this at this point, like, I'm still no better at Haskell than I was before. You know, like, I think it's, yeah. I think it's neat that there are, like, you know, sometimes these analogies that you can make or whatever. But, yeah, I don't know. I feel like if you want to program in Haskell, you should just program in Haskell.
I love this. This is going to be such a good cut. I'm going to edit precisely that part and then tweet it. Hey, Kesaragam. No, that is great. I love it. I love it. That is really good stuff. But I mean, but you also studied Hot, and Hot definitely is category theory, right? So there is something there.
That's true. Yeah. A lot of like a lot of Hot is like, well, yeah, I mean, it's like type theory, but there's also like Hot, I feel like, is a lot of analogies, because it starts with this thing that, you know, type theorists probably care about. Okay, you had a type theory, you've got like different notions of equivalence, and like, how do you sort of relate these and whatever. And then what is it, like Vladimir Vavadsky or whatever goes, hang on a minute, this is just an infinity groupoid, right? This is just a space up to homotopy. What if we used like topology to study this like weird new kind of logic or whatever? And it turns out that like the analogy just like keeps going further and further and further, right? Like higher inductive types or CW complexes, whatever. But yeah, like it's I think that's really where the analogies start to shine, is like you can take ideas from like topology and category theory and stuff like that and apply them here to like genuinely get some insight into what's going on in the type theory. And you can sort of go the other way around. Like you can start treating Hot as like a framework for like synthetic homotopy theory or whatever. And you can like, you know, I don't know, you can compute fundamental groups without ever talking about points or continuous maps or like anything like this. I think that's really cool. I don't know how much topologists care about being able to do that, but I think philosophically it's really neat that that works.
I feel like one of the reasons why category theory started, well, first there was the monad stuff that allegedly did come from category theory, but people were really, really excited about homotopy type theory. Mm-hmm. I feel like it lost a little bit of steam this last 5 years or so. This is just a feeling I have in the community, you know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm saying this as very much an outsider. I don't do anything related to this. But like, I don't know. I get the feeling that like, once you add univalence, you get a lot of things that aren't immediately computable. And like type theorists and like PL people tend to not like that very much. And so, you know, maybe there's been a shift in that community away from like classical Hot and towards things like cubicle type theory, which sort of give you this like computability back. I don't know. I don't understand cubicle sets, to be honest. They kind of scare me. So I've kept a healthy distance from that particular rabbit hole. But I mean, it seems I guess cool on the surface.
Now that you're finishing your PhD, you're gonna start working on a like more industrial setting, right? You're going to Verdize. But in this interest that you have been pursuing in category theory, homotopy type theory, this kind of things, do you think that has scratched this itch inside of you to learn these higher algebraic notions in mathematics? Or do you see yourself, I don't know, like learning, like where are you going from here in this, in when we're talking about category theory and homotopy type theory and all of this?
I think it definitely scratched that like deep itch that I had a few years ago. I think some of it's still there. Like I enjoy, for example, tuning into like lectures at the like Purdue Topology Seminar or whatever, because often they'll like say something that I recognize and we're like, hey, I, you know, that's cool. I like hearing about this. And a big thing is I remember really liking how it felt to be learning all of this stuff for the first time, and like the sort of satisfaction that I would get from like understanding it and being like, oh yeah, this is like, I can now explicitly point to something that that confused the hell out of me, you know, a month ago, and now I can explain it, and like that feels really, really good. Or like I remember that feeling really good. And so I have been kind of trying to you know, pick something else up or pick up like other areas of math that I think could, you know, help me chase that high, I guess. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm still very okay with the fact that it's probably never going to come up in like a meaningful or practical way in you know, my day-to-day life or like my technical work or whatever. But I don't think it has to. I think it's you know, fun for its own sake.
No, but that's exactly the point that I'm asking, in the sense of like, are you still gonna keep studying some other of these concepts going forward?
Like, yeah, I think so.
Interesting for you.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've heard people say the word sheaf a lot, like sheaves.
True.
And so, you know, that's currently my what's the word? That's currently what I'm going for, trying to read a little bit about this. Of course, I think this means that I have to understand a little bit of algebraic geometry, and I'm not looking forward to that, but maybe it'll be worth it.
Well, I've also been streaming on Twitch.
Oh, hi, a lot. I've streamed once.
Oh, you plan to? Yeah. Talking and reading the sheaf textbook.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Sheaves in geometry and logic. Yeah. I streamed once a week ago, or like a couple of weeks ago. It was a week ago, going through like the first chapter and getting really confused at like the notions of subobject classifiers in different categories, and just like working through a bunch of examples to try to convince myself that they made sense. I suspect that Franciel was my only viewer, besides the like spam bot that joined halfway through.
I hate those. They're annoying, right?
But
you're gonna say, "Oh my god, it's just a bot."
But yeah, I mean, I think it's a fun thing that I want to keep doing.
Let us know. Join our Discord. Post on Discord over
there. Yeah, absolutely.
If you have, are you still on Twitter, on X? Because I can.
Yeah, I am. I don't check it very much. I'm more on Blue Sky now.
Yeah, I'm on Blue Sky as well. I was canceled on Mastodon on types.pl, so I'm not
really?
There. Yeah. I'm not going back. So
yeah, that's fair.
But yeah, let me know. Let us know if you have a schedule, like if you have a date, like let us know. We're gonna post.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. That's gonna be fun. They don't know they have a sheaf book. That's cool.
It's like 600 pages.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Holy shit. No, but I was in a summer school last year that I was having lectures with T.A. Kokan. Mm-hmm. And
Very cool.
Nobody understood much, man.
Okay.
It was way too mathematically abstract, and like I would ask some other people, like most of people are way above our heads, you know. There are just one or two mathematicians in the room that are like, Yeah. It's a little rough, but we can follow. Like, there, it's very interesting stuff. And I remember him mentioning ships a lot. So
yeah,
there you go.
Yeah, yeah.
That's it. That's what I took away from it too. That's awesome, man. That's very interesting, and really surprising to me, because you know, like, you're actually in ECE's,
yeah,
electrical engineering, yeah. Right? What does ECE stand for?
Electrical and computer engineering. Yeah,
electrical computing.
I don't do any of the electrical stuff.
Is there anything else that you wanna talk about, this research side and mathematics and your thesis?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like if you like, I could talk about this for like days. So maybe it is good to put a stop to it.
Yeah, that's the thing I keep saying. Like, when I meet a new person and I mention that I finished a master's, I was doing a PhD, they're like, "Oh, so tell me about it." And I'm like, "That's
yeah,
not seriously. You don't want us to go there. I'm gonna bore so much here.
No, this is not gonna be as fun for you as you think.
As you think you are, yeah." But another topic that we wanted to cover today is something that we started talking a little bit in the last episode with Francil, which is in the back over there. You heard her voice earlier, which is the notion of mental health in grad school. So as we mentioned, Francil is starting, you know, like, is starting her academic life, is applying to go to a PhD, which I'm very confident that she will be very successful. We'll have great letters, great offers on her desk soon. And so the notion that we have here is try to continue that conversation a little bit. What are the things that you would add in this sense of, you know, what would you tell for, now that you finish your PhD, what would you tell for students to keep in mind to have a good PhD, you know, to not, maybe not burn out, but specifically to strive in their PhD and to come out successful out of it?
Yeah, I think, like, the biggest thing for me that kept me from, like, completely going crazy is having something else to sort of consistently do. So sometimes that was math, like category theory, or like these other classes that I was taking. Often that was something like playing an instrument, like playing the violin. But having a, you know, having something that I can do, that I can like think about, or something that I can like get satisfaction from or like get joy from, that is not related to you know, benchmarks not running fast or like reviews looking bad or anything like this, is I think really, really important. Even like, I don't know, even when research is going like relatively well, like relatively okay, I think having something that sort of like forces me to take a break from that and think about something completely unrelated, I don't know, it like, I think it held off the burnout for a lot longer than, or it helped me like hold off burnout for a lot longer than I otherwise would have been able to. So I think that's really useful. I'm also, you know, very, very lucky with Milan as my advisor, because, I mean, first of all, he's, you know, we've joked about it, but he was like very, very supportive of all of this stuff. 'Cause I think he kind of like knew that, you know, this was something that I had to do. And so he, I think, you know, being supportive of that sort of thing in general, just like having a good advisor, like someone who, you know, pushes you to do better, but also kind of recognizes that sometimes you need a mental health day, or like sometimes, you know, things are going to go not well and it's not entirely your fault and like you need help feeling better about that or whatever. I think Milan's been really, really good at that. And so, yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, my choice of advisor ended up mattering a lot more than choice of topic, at least for my PhD. Like I said, like I didn't really know what PL was. I didn't really, you know, care a ton about most of the technical things that I work on now when I came into grad school. And so I think if Milan was working on anything else, or like if Milan had put me on any other project, I think I would have been just as okay with it. But I think having a different advisor, having like, you know, I don't know, maybe a worse advisor who's working on the same topics would not have gone as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I think you really hit the right note there. Like sometimes just working for the right person is so much more important than working on a particular project or a particular problem. Because mm-hmm. as we were talking another day, like we love solving problems. We love the puzzle, right?
Yeah.
This puzzle aspect of like chasing that high of elation in the sense of where do I go next? Like and finding our way in a problem and trying to figure out and being lost and slowly making sense of things. And that moment of that aha that it comes about and like, I get it.
Exactly.
So good. Yeah. So good, right? Damn, I remember when I finished my undergrad thesis and I could hit that QED. It was a Koch project, and I hit that QED of the last theorem.
Yeah.
I swear to God, it was 2 a.m. in the morning. I started dancing in my apartment like, I'm
so good.
I'm not doing a 1 year of hard work. I was so stuck.
Yep.
It's so good. It's so nice. But
Can I jump in?
Yeah.
So I guess two questions, right? So one of them was like, so what do you do to actually be able to keep up with like the stuff that's not what your research is? Because I feel like I don't really like the mark, like I don't know if I should both get myself to do it if I'm, you know, doing a PhD.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think like so for me, for example, playing the violin, I I enrolled in the like chamber, I don't know, class, club, whatever you want to call it. But I did chamber, which in particular means that every week I have a commitment of like a specific hour where I have to go meet four other people to sit down and play and practice. And like having like sort of being forced to do that, like being forced to work that into my schedule because there's like other people who are like also doing this, was really useful because, you know, I don't know, like people sort of asked me, you know, other people that I knew who played instruments, but they sort of like stopped playing in grad school or whatever, you know, there's this question of like, well, why are you adding an extra thing to your plate? Why are you taking essentially another class that you don't have to take, when you could just like just practice at home or just like, you know, practice on your own time when you feel like it? And I'm like, yeah, I could, but I probably won't. Like, realistically, I know myself, I'm probably gonna forget, or I'm probably gonna be too tired or too lazy, and it's just probably never gonna happen. And, you know, in the long run, I'm gonna feel a lot worse about it. And so I don't know, maybe this slowed down my research progress a little bit, because if I hadn't been, you know, going to chamber and like practicing for that and stuff like that, then I don't know, maybe I would have gotten a paper out, you know, a week sooner or whatever. But
not only feel burned out along the way.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like, I would rather have a slow and steady 6 years than you know, hate myself and, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. This seems worth it to me.
No, 6 years is very successful, I would say. Like, very good, very good rate, and just steady. Yeah.
And then another question is, like, can you explain specifically what makes Milan's a great ambassador to you?
No, great question.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of things that I'm, you know, I've been trying to like put my finger on here. But one big thing is he's really, really good at getting me excited about something. So like he, you know, I'll sit down in a meeting with him and I'll be like, this isn't working. Like my research prop, like, you know, I'm very stuck. I like the last three things that I've tried just haven't worked. I have no idea where to go from this. And, you know, internally, what I'll really be saying is like, this is like, I'm finding myself losing interest in this research problem or whatever. But we'll sit down and we'll have a meeting and he'll be like, oh, you know, have we like, can you think about it this way? Or like, you know, maybe some way to reframe the problem, or just like, just talking through the things that I've tried that haven't worked or whatever. And what I'll realize is like coming out of that meeting with Milan, I'll just have like a little bit more, you know, like spring in my stuff. I'll be like, oh, you know what? Yeah, this is a really cool problem to be working on. And I do have things that I want to try now. And like, he's like, I don't know what it is, but he's just like really, really good at doing that. And I've seen this with like, you know, we've had like a few undergrads work with me on different parts of the stuff. But like I kind of see it on their faces too, where, you know, I'll try to like explain the problem that I'm working on and they'll be like, uh-huh, yeah, that makes sense. And then we'll sit down in a meeting with Milan and he'll kind of like talk about it and they'll be like, whoa, yeah, that's so cool. And I'm like, yeah, I know, right? Like, this is what I'm trying to communicate. But yeah, I think that's like one of the biggest things is he's very good at like at making me want to do the thing. And this means that he doesn't have to like force me to do the thing, and he also doesn't have to like take a backseat while I crash and burn. Like he, you know, I don't know, he's very good at like inspiring that. The other thing is, I think he really knows when to like, when to be hands on versus hands off is what I'll say. So like my very first paper that I ever wrote, it was terrible, but you know, I was like, okay, I feel like I can write the technical content of this, and he was like, focus on the technical content. I'll take a pass over the introduction and I'll like write something up and like show you how I did it. And like, you tell me how you feel. And I was like, oh yeah, this is great. This is so easy. All I have to do is write, you know, write technical stuff. And my advisor fills in all of the boring stuff for me. And, you know, like that's what I needed for that first paper, is to not be stressed about how to write a good introduction. And then my second paper came around and I was like, hey, Milan, are you going to write the intro for me? He was like, no, why don't you take a crack at it? And I was like, okay. And I wrote something. And it was like garbage. And he was like, okay, so here's where we went wrong. Like, you're focusing on this instead of this other thing, which is what the paper is really about. And, you know, like gave me feedback to sort of improve. And now it's gotten to the point where like the most recent paper that I wrote, that, you know, I presented at PLDI last summer or whatever, I like, I wrote the entire introduction because he refused to look at any of it. He was like, no, like, you got this. This is your paper. You should write it. I wrote the entire thing and, like, finally sent him, like, a draft of the section. And I was like, all right, any feedback? And he was like, no, this looks good to me.
Whoa.
Are you joking right now? Like, are you just saying that? Or, like, what's going on? He was like, yeah, no, I think you nailed it. Wow. I think you did it. And I was like, that's crazy. But, like, if he hadn't held my hand the first time and then, like, made sure to not hold my hand after that, like, I don't know. I think he did the exact right amount of hand-holding to, like, yeah, I mean, it feels amazing, right? To, like, get to the point where I'm like, yeah, I wrote that. Like, I feel good about having written that. And, like, I read back over it and I'm like, yeah, this sounds kind of good, actually. So, I don't know. I think cultivating that is another, like, really cool thing that he's able to do. And he's got a great personality. I feel like we have a lot of like good rapport. He's weirdly good at memes, I think, for someone like him. He'll often roast me in like our group like Slack channel with like GIFs or GIFs or whatever that I just like I wouldn't have been able to like pull out. He'll just do it, and I'm like, oh wow, I can't believe I've been out memed by my advisor in this moment. I have to like go sit down in a corner and think about my life, but it's like amazing. And yeah. I think it also makes me like a lot more comfortable with him because he doesn't cultivate this like this aura of like, you know, oh, he's like the big professor and I have to be very like careful and like scared about what I say to him and stuff like this. Like I feel like at this point when we interact, it's a lot more as like, oh, he's my friend who knows a lot more about this stuff than I do. But like, I'm going to my friend for advice and like, you know, talking to him in that capacity as opposed to somebody that I'm scared of. I think that's also really important.
Ben sometimes have some really, really good memes. I think every class, if it takes at least one lecture, will have like, oh, it's really good meme. That's awesome, man. This is so inspiring, really, because, you know, I've heard so many horror stories about bad advisors. Like, you wouldn't believe it. Which is one of the reasons I focus so much on mental health, because I see the need of that. But, you know, like, listening to the other side of it, that there are some really incredible people out there, you know, that really, really make a difference and really inspires and why. And you can really put your finger on all that process. And thanks, Francine, for asking that question. That was very nice to hear. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, so we talked about you know, keeping your interest, keeping you doing your violin. How did you call it? Like going into a bubble? What chamber? Going chamber? That when you go to practice?
Yeah, with yeah. Like chamber orchestra. Yeah,
and chamber orchestra. So you actually did some presentation. Like,
yeah, we perform once a semester. Like, we rehearse all semester and then like have a like recital at the end of the semester. And that's a good like, you know, like forcing function to like ensure that I sort of show up and practice my part, because if I don't, it's not myself I'm disappointing, you know, it's everyone around
me. Yeah. So did you pick up violin during your PhD or did you start before?
I've been playing since elementary school.
Okay.
I've been playing, oh God, this feels terrible to say. I've been playing violin for the last like 18 years.
Why is that terrible?
Yeah. And like, it's been great. And, you know, I did it in undergrad and like the like Purdue Philharmonic Orchestra. And I kind of thought that I would have to stop playing violin in grad school. And I did stop the full orchestra because that was just too much of a time commitment.
Yeah.
But I'm very happy that I've been able to kind of keep up with it a little bit.
That's awesome. That is so great. The last thing is like, so you're going to Veridize now. Do you mm-hmm. see yourself entirely outside of academia, or is this, you see yourself more in like a break from academia?
Maybe more the latter. One thing that I really like about Veridize, it is also, you know, very, very research adjacent. Yeah. And so I still get the same feeling of like here's some papers, read these and like see if there's any cool ideas that we can use, or like, you know, we're working on this thing and like all of a sudden there'll be a problem that's not just an engineering problem. You have to sort of like, you have to do like a little bit of that same sort of like researchy thinking, same like puzzle, like problem solving or whatever to figure it out. So that's really cool. It is also fun feeling like I'm back in like early grad school, because you know, a lot of the work that they do is like formal methods and like zero knowledge proofs and stuff, which, you know, I've like seen, and, you know, I've, you know, it's been like on my periphery, but it's definitely not what I'm an expert in. And so reading these papers that I can, you know, understand line by line, but don't have like a super, like I'm not super comfortable with or whatever, is, I don't know, it's cool to be like, oh yeah, I'm learning new things again. Like I'm in that same position that I was in the first year of my PhD, where like I'm reading these papers and I know that I have to understand these to solve some problems, and I don't understand them yet, but I will, and that's great.
That's awesome. I love it. Any closing remarks for yourself?
So like, does that mean that you like would still want to pursue that in Daniel like at first then?
I think I wanna, you know, think about it. I do like the research aspect. I would like to keep doing researchy things.
Yeah.
But it's not only academia that allows that. Academia, you are overloaded with many other things, such as teaching, mentoring, and often enough we're not really doing research. So doing pure research often enough is better outside of academia. That's what I'm interested in. Sometimes. Well, thank you so much for this. It was such a nice conversation. And yeah, man, very glad that we made this.
Great. Yeah.
And I hope you guys enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Raghav was amazing. I was actually telling him after the episode how he has changed a lot in the last years that we've met. So I think we've met in 2019 or 20, if I'm not mistaken. He was extremely shy and, you know, would be on his side, wouldn't talk much. And sometimes I would have a lot of trouble understanding what he was saying because he's so smart and he's always, you know, like talking above. He was always talking above my head. And I feel like after his PhD, he's a lot more confident on his skills, and his communication style has greatly, greatly improved. So it was so nice. It was so great to perceive all of these changes, all his growth. It was an extremely incredible conversation. It was a little on the shorter side because I had a shuttle to grab, because I was literally leaving the US right after that episode was recorded. So then I came back to Brazil and here we are. I think that's it. As I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, I'm going to be releasing a new Patreon. I think I'm going to be releasing a Patreon episode before or after each one of the regular episodes, to just have a very nice conversation with you guys. This month I decided to release a talk that I gave at Sweden about the history of the last told part of the history of computation, And so talk about Church and Turing and what is type theory and all of that. I really appreciate that talk. I really like it, but it's a very introductory level conversation. I felt that this is a good place to share this talk. That's it. If you guys are able to contribute anyhow, please consider becoming a Patreon. Otherwise, supports at Ko-Fi are always, always welcome. We still have the merch store going strongly. Oh yeah, I totally forgot to say at the beginning. We currently have a Black Friday happening, and it's only going to last for a couple of weeks in December, okay? Don't wait, don't expect so much. So we have 15% off throughout the whole website, and you don't need any discount codes. It's already applied at checkout. That's it. If you have any questions, any remarks, any things that you want to tell me, go to contact@typetheoryforall.com. I literally read and try to reply all of the emails. We don't receive much, so I still have a bunch of time to reply to emails. That's it. See you guys next time. Keep yourself healthy.